I was at the library looking at a fascinating book called The Annotated Mother Goose. Fascinating reading. Gives the stories behind the nursery rhymes that we sing and our children play with. But we have forgotten their underlying story, and I find it fascinating to discover what these songs were intended to convey. I know probably you've heard of this one, Ring Around the Rosies, A Pocket Full of Posies, a tissue, we all fall down. This originated in 17th century London during a plague called the Black Death, and each line of the rhyme was a reference to the plague. Ring Around the Rosies referred to the small red-like rash that would appear on the person so infected. A Pocket Full of Posies was their belief, superstitious belief, that if they would stuff their pockets full of sweet-smelling flowers, the sweet smell would drive the demons away that brought the disease. A tissue, a reference to the constant sneezing, which was a common symptom of the plague. The phrase, we all fall down, we all die. It was a gloomy chant, really, of unbelievable sadness. I was looking for this particular history, and along the way came across some other rhymes that are very interesting. This one about little Jack Horner, you remember him sitting in a corner eating his Christmas pie? Jack Horner was an employee of Richard Whiting, who was the last abbot of Glastonbury Castle in London. During the time when King Henry VIII was taking all of the land he could get his royal hands on, the abbot wanted to get in good with the king, and so he, at Christmas time, sent the king a pie. It was hollow inside. Underneath the crust were 12 deeds to wealthy estates that he was going to secretly convey to the king. Jack Horner knew about it, and so on his way to deliver the pie, he opened the pie, he pulled out a plum, that is a good piece of land, for himself, upon which his relatives moved and where they lived for centuries. And so the rhyme, little Jack Horner sat in a corner eating a Christmas pie, he put in his thumb and pulled out a plum and said, what a good boy am I. Here's another one that... I'm not trying to start a conspiracy against Mother Goose, by the way. I don't have that kind of courage. But I stumbled across this one. You can say this one with me. Humpty Dumpty sat on a wall. Humpty Dumpty had a great fall. And all the king's horses and all the king's men couldn't put Humpty together again. Now, this isn't a nursery rhyme about secret dealings with the king or the betrayal of friends or some widespread disease, but it was a lament over the condition of mankind. It first appeared in print, I read, in 1803. Humpty Dumpty was cast as an egg, and that explains why, having fallen off the wall and broken apart, he couldn't be put back together again. But eggs don't sit on fences, and they aren't men. The original rhyme maker for this rhyme maker, that little egg man, was intended to be a symbol that represented the origin of life, thus the egg, the world of humanity, in this rhyme maker's thinking. The rhyme was designed to lament the fact that humanity has fallen and is broken, and even the most powerful men on planet Earth, the king, his horses, and all of his men, cannot put Humpty back together again. The meaning was this lamenting with despair over a fallen and broken world. One contemporary author wrote, that's the world we live in. We live in a world that specializes in producing broken people. And once broken, we all discover that no power on earth can put life together again. The book of Nehemiah is a story about broken people and broken things. It will reveal behind the scenes deception, betrayal. It will expose an epidemic of moral compromise and sin and spiritual apathy. But it's more than a bedtime story about a broken wall that gets fixed. It's a true life story about broken people who are restored by a man who happened to have a broken heart named Nehemiah. And frankly, I have been arrested by this deeply burdened man. When most believers, including myself, have studied this in the past, I've even taught through this book over 10 years ago, we and I tended to rush to the prayer of Nehemiah. In fact, I preached one sermon on the first chapter of Nehemiah. I went right to the prayer. And you catalog it so neatly in its four components, which forms the acrostic acts. Adoration, confession, thanksgiving, supplication. There! Go pray like that! That's the model prayer. Well, it is a model of a prayer, but it emanated from a deeply burdened man. A man who had to have God's maximum attention because it came out of his broken heart over this broken world. You can see the evidence of burden and brokenness. Verse 6, please listen to my prayer, he pleads. In verse 11, he says, oh Lord, I beg thee, listen to my prayer. I beg you, please listen. 11 times throughout this book, Nehemiah is imploring the attention of God. 3 times in the closing chapter, Nehemiah cries out, oh my God, remember me. In fact, the book ends with the phrase, oh God, remember me. It's the same phrase in the Greek translation of the Old Testament that you find in the Gospel by Luke that comes from the lips of that dying thief hanging on the cross beside Christ when he says, oh Lord, remember me. It is this lamenting wail that basically says, I want to be where you are. I want to go where you go. I want to walk where you walk. I want to think after you. And oh God, please think after me. Nehemiah was a man who desperately wanted the maximum attention of God. And he, like all others like him, are the living illustration of people I think God was thinking about when he said to his prophet Jeremiah, you will seek me and find me when you search for me with all your heart, Jeremiah 29:13. Now wait a second, aren't we all under the sovereign gaze of an omniscient God? Nothing on earth escapes his attention. So what is God talking about when he says that he will be discovered by those who desperately search for him with their whole heart? What did David mean when he said, blessed or happy is the one who seeks after God with his whole heart, Psalm 119:2. Or Paul cried, oh, that I may know him. Didn't he already know him? The power of his resurrection, the fellowship of his sufferings, Philippians 3:10. What did the writer of Hebrews mean when he said that God is a rewarder of those who diligently seek after him? Hebrews 11:6. Who is the man today? Who is the woman today that has this intimate, close, rewarded pursuit, discovery of God? How do we gain the maximum attention, this intimacy with God, where we beg of Him His close attention, but somehow is different from the attention we already have? The answer is in chapter 1 of the memoirs of a man who one day stopped what he was doing and began to weep over the condition of Humpty Dumpty. See, before Nehemiah ever began to rebuild, he first sat down to cry over brokenness that just couldn't be fixed by any power on earth. The Hebrew name Nehemiah means the consolation of God. It's a wonderful name. He'll live up to it. Nehemiah will bring to the people the consolation of God, the relief of God, the solace, the encouragement, the condolence of God. He will be the instrument of restoration and rebuilding in lives, not just walls. In verse 11, if you look there, chapter 1, Nehemiah tells us that his occupational title was cupbearer. He doesn't say much more. We know from history that he would happen to then be the best person in the entire kingdom to get close enough to the king to poison him. The enemies of the king knew that, no doubt, often bribed him or attempted to overthrow the king in their coup attempts. Assassination attempts were commonplace. In fact, you may remember in the book of Esther that Mordecai overhears an assassination attempt on this man's father. And Mordecai rescues him. Perhaps you remember the story of Joseph, how Joseph is languishing in prison and Pharaoh throws into prison his baker and his cupbearer. And evidently an investigation takes place to discover which one of them was guilty, evidently, of trying to poison him through his food. It was the baker who was found guilty and later executed, while the cupbearer was exonerated. And Genesis 40:21 says, and he returned to his place and put the cup back into Pharaoh's hand. Nehemiah put the cup into Artaxerxes' hand. Xenophon, who happened to be a student of Socrates, said this, giving us a little insight. Now, it's a well-known fact that the cupbearer, when they offered the cup, drew off some of it and swallowed it down so that if they should put poison in it, they may not profit by it. I love the way that's put. In other words, long live the king, but no more cupbearer. The cupbearer was the most trusted man, perhaps, in the kingdom by the king. By the way, the king that Nehemiah served knew full well the threat of death, for his father, whom Mordecai had rescued, his father later died in an assassination attempt that was successful. The role involved more than handing a cup. The apocryphal book of Tobit gives a little insight in saying that the man was the administrator of the accounts. He was a trusted associate of the king, close enough to kill the king, but put there closely by him to save his life. You notice, if you go back to verse 1, that we're given a chronological clue of when these things are about to happen, and we're also told where Nehemiah was. It happened in the month of Chislev, it's around December, in the 20th year, while I was in Susa, the capital. So here he is living with the king and the cabinet in the palace of Susa. This was the winter resort of the kings. This was the playground of the kings. The palace and grounds covered 5,000 acres. Archaeologists have uncovered gems and gold built right into the architecture. Murals have been uncovered with bulls bearing wings. Glazed bricks, not exactly our choice of painting for our home, but it must have been an absolutely stunning sight. If you were in the king's palace in Susa for the winter time, you were in the middle of power and influence and affluence. All of that to say, he had it, so to speak, made in the shade. As a Jew in a foreign kingdom, he had risen. He had achieved an enviable life. He had powerful friends. He had financial security. He was worlds away from a broken down city called Jerusalem, 800 miles away. And that little Jerusalem, by the way, was four times smaller than this one palace. Why would he ever care? Little broken Jerusalem. Verse 2. And Hannah and I, one of my brothers, one of my brothers and some men from Judah came, and I asked them concerning the Jews who had escaped and had survived the captivity and about Jerusalem. Now, is this just polite? How's it going out there? And how you guys doing? How's the weather? Snow? What do you know? No. He says, tell me about the people and tell me about the city. And did they ever tell them? Verse 3. And they said to me, the remnant there in the province who survived the captivity are in great distress and reproach, and the wall of Jerusalem is broken down and its gates are burned with fire. Now, this is not news. Babylon did this years ago. Didn't he know? Why ask? Because the walls were under construction during the return of a man named Ezra. And Ezra and Nehemiah will later team up together. But Ezra has gone ahead of Nehemiah, and he's attempted to rebuild, and the building had started on the walls, ultimately getting high enough to perhaps hang a gate or two. But in Ezra chapter 4, the work was forced to stop. And most believe that the enemies of the Jews came and broke down and burned everything they had done up to that point. So Nehemiah is basically asking, hey, how's it going under Ezra? How is the work that's been started again after all of these years? How are the walls coming? Oh, they've been torn down. The work has stopped. The people have thrown in the towel in total discouragement and despair. Nehemiah later writes in his journal in verse 4, it came about when I heard these words, I sat down and wept. What in fact happens are several things. I want to give you them. They're what we could call five responses of a broken-hearted man, or symptoms of a broken or a burdened heart. That's all we'll have time for, just to talk about his burden. Number one is the word contemplation. I sat down. In other words, I stopped. Nehemiah took time to think and to contemplate the report he had just heard. He didn't just listen to their report. He heard. There's a difference between listening to someone and hearing them, right? Have you fellows ever had your wife tell you that? There's a difference between, and you're going, yeah, I'm hearing you, sure, right, right. But, oh, okay, I didn't hear you. Now I'm listening. I hear. There's a difference. He is not only listening, but he is hearing. He felt the anguish of those who were talking. He stopped his normal life of cup-bearing to listen and to hear the news. Number two, compassion. He says, I sat down and I wept. Proof that he heard. I wept. The World Monitor reported some time ago, quote, preschool teachers, administrators, and child development leaders, specialists, say the most important thing for a child to learn is, quote, self-reliance. Seven times more educators said that children should learn self-reliance and self-confidence than sympathy and concern for others. So the solution then of the average educator in our community today would be to go out on the street and tell Humpty Dumpty to get it together, to just pull himself together. You fell off the wall. You didn't believe in yourself. Have faith in you. The answers are in you. Now pull yourself up together. The rhyme would go something like this. Humpty Dumpty sat on a wall. Humpty Dumpty had a great fall. And all the humanist scholars and professors just told Humpty Dumpty to get it together. People are broken. It's their fault. They didn't believe in themselves enough. Don't develop sympathy or empathy. Oh, look at this man. He cried. When's the last time you've cried over a broken world? The third thing that marked him was concern. I sat down and wept and mourned for days. The word mourned is the Hebrew verb aval. It literally means to mourn for the dead. It's a deep, sorrowful mourning. It doesn't soon pass away, it lingers on. In fact, we know from the text that it'll spend December to April. He will mourn for about 4 months. He is weeping and he is in deep lamenting and deep mourning. One author writes, how few the men in these days who can weep at the evils and abominations of our times. How rare those who are sufficiently interested and concerned for the welfare of the church to mourn. Mourning and weeping over the decay of religion, the decline of revival power, and the fearful inroads of worldliness into the church are almost an unknown quantity. That was written by E.M. Bounds 100 years ago. If he had a problem then, can you imagine what it is today? And again, I ask you and myself, when is the last time we have cried over a broken world? The fourth word is concentration. I sat down and wept and mourned for days, and I was fasting. Now, this wasn't simply Nehemiah taking a little time off of work and skipping his sandwich to go pray and cry a little bit. The word implies the fact that he had lost his appetite. He was fasting not simply because he wanted to so focus on the burden that God had given him and his lamenting before God for God's maximum attention. He was actually fasting because he couldn't eat. You've had a burden before, I'm sure, like that, where food is of no interest to you. He, for 4 months, had lost his appetite. This was the burden of this man's heart. After all of that, and during all of that, all of these things happening simultaneously, there is Fifth Communion. I was praying before the God of heaven. Now, a number of different words are used in the Hebrew Bible for praying. This one involves pleading. This one involves begging. It implies deep emotion. It is a lamenting before God in desperation that you've got to hear from God. You've got to know. You have to decide. You must hear. You've had times like that in your own life, perhaps, where you are brought in agony to your knees. Like Abraham Lincoln in that classic quote where he said, I've often been driven to my knees knowing there was nowhere else to go. And you lament before God and you cry out to Him, you must have His maximum attention. Can you imagine weeping and mourning and fasting and praying for 4 hours? For 4 days? for 4 weeks, 4 months. We have trouble if we don't hear from God and get an answer in 4 minutes. A man with a burden like Nehemiah's was named John Knox. He was the Scottish reformer who happened to serve our Lord during the time of the reign of a woman nicknamed Bloody Mary because she shed the blood of many a Protestant. But he had the habit of praying in her garden outside her palace windows. Bloody Mary said that of John Knox, she feared his prayers more than anything on earth. And he would pray in her gardens loud enough for her to hear, "Oh God, give me Scotland or I die." Have you ever prayed, "Oh God, give me my children for you, lest I die. Oh God, give me my family or I die. Oh God, give me that co-worker or I die. Oh, I'm so burdened. Oh God, give me this city or I die." Nehemiah had every reason not to care. He'd been born in captivity. He'd been reared outside of Jerusalem, had never been there. He'd never worshipped in the temple. He had a great career in Persia. He was the king's right hand, confidant and protector. Why would he ever pray, "Oh God, give me Jerusalem or I die"? Why would he ever go to a broken down city, to a people he didn't know, and to a problem he didn't create? That's for somebody else. Why should I care? He cared because he ultimately, as a man, was burdened for the glory of God to shine in and through Jerusalem, the holy city, and for the people of God to be restored in that city so that they could once again worship with freedom and great joy this one and only living God. And then he begins to pray. Let me give you two thoughts as we wrap up this morning's study. Two crucial lessons of application. Number one, if you want the maximum attention of God, He must first have the maximum attention of you. Bad grammar, but you get the point. You want Him to be available to you? Great. Are you available to Him? You want to move His heart? Great. Question is, can He move yours? Has He moved yours? If you want the maximum attention of God, you must be willing to receive the maximum burden from God. I would define burden, this burden of Nehemiah, in three different ways or three different aspects. Number one, an overwhelming concern with some aspect of human distress or sin. An irresistible conviction that God has an available remedy. An unreserved compliance that God use you to deliver the remedy. In other words, you are convinced there is a problem and you are passionate before God that He used you to provide the solution or to be a part of it. You know, it's easier, isn't it? Just to say, "Oh Lord, you know, do this, Lord, do that, Lord, bless this, Lord, bless that, Lord, bless him, Lord, bless her, Lord, help her, help him, and oh, Lord, move in this way, Lord, come through for her in that way, oh, Lord, deliver him." What if a voice from heaven came and said, "Hey, 9 out of the 10 things you just prayed about are your situation. Up to you. Your responsibility. I'll wait for you." That's exactly the application of Paul's words to the Galatians when he said, "You bear one another's burdens." Try that one on. Nehemiah will bear the burden of a broken Jerusalem and a broken nation. One author wrote, "A burdened God is at work in the world today, and He's looking for burdened believers through whom He may work." Is it any wonder why we would rather dash to the prayer and say our little ACTS? No wonder we don't want God's maximum attention. No wonder we really don't want to be part of the solution. We really don't want to be the fixer, the restorer, the rebuilder. Is it any wonder why the church plays religious games for a couple of hours a week rather than restore and rebuild broken things? We didn't know God would start with us. We didn't know God would so hammer away at our hearts before He ever asks us to hammer up a wall. We'd rather look at what Nehemiah did rather than who Nehemiah was and the burden that preceded the birth of his life ministry. We didn't know that we would be uncomfortable. We didn't know that to fellowship in his sufferings and to have his attention meant that we would also share his agony. Didn't know it meant that. Could we rewrite that again to say, Humpty Dumpty sat on a wall. Humpty Dumpty had a great fall. And to all the king's horses and to all the king's men, do we really care enough to put Humpty back together again? Anybody here willing to have a broken heart? To feel the weight of the burden of what burdens God's heart? If you are, and you're prepared to begin to pray this prayer, and you are in so praying prepared to gain the maximum attention of God.